The understanding was that we would be more effective in making an argument to the public about the wisdom of our approach to trying to solve a problem if we were mindful of how we were going to make that case from the beginning.
It's only been a couple of months since the executive torch was passed from Obama to Trump. And while the differences between the two administrations have been stark on many levels, nowhere has it been more publicly visible than in the two administrations' approach to communications. And beside the president himself, no single person has been more publicly associated with that change than White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer. But the job of press secretary is hardly an easy one, and few know that as well as today's guest. Hello and welcome to the Harvard Kennedy School PolicyCast. I'm your host, Matt Cadwallader, and today we're joined by former White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest. He's here for a JFK Junior Forum event sponsored by the Kennedy School's Center for Public Leadership. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's good to see you, Matt.
So you're watching what's happening from outside government now. Obviously, it's been a fairly busy few months since President Obama stepped down and President Trump was inaugurated. I'd love to hear just your overview, your thoughts, your general thoughts about what's been happening.
Yeah. Well, President Trump ran for this job, vowing to shake things up and to do things very differently than they've been done in the past. And for better or worse, that's at least one promise that he's kept.
Mm-hmm.
His style of communicating with the public, to put it mildly, is different than not just President Obama, but then different than many of his predecessors. Divining what his longer-term strategy is for accomplishing his agenda is something that has not been explicitly laid out by his team. And it has some significant consequences for the country, both in terms of the way that domestic programs in the United States are being run, whether that's the Affordable Care Act or some of our environmental programs, but it also has consequences for our relationships with countries around the world who I think are asking themselves, well, President Obama or President Trump is keeping his promise to do things differently, but what does that mean for our relationship? How different is our relationship with the United States going to be? And how different of a force is the United States going to be around the world? And will they continue to be forceful? Will they be forceful in the same way? Will they be forceful in the support of the same issues and values that they were in the past? And these are all unanswered questions, and I think to a lot of people that's more than a little unsettling.
I got to ask, how often do you do a double take these days when someone references something the president has done and you think, oh, not my president?
it's worse. It's when I'm talking that I say, oh, you know, the president thinks this or this is what happens in the White House. And I realize it's a different president in a different White House. Fortunately, I haven't been talking too much in public lately, so most of those corrections have been in private.
The Trump administration's communications efforts have, well, they set themselves apart very early on. Your successor, Sean Spicer, was very forceful early on talking about how, I think it was the inauguration crowd size, disputing the media accounts of it.
Yeah.
How would you have gone about that differently had you been in the same shoes with a president who perhaps insists upon you, bringing that message to the reporters who might not believe you for, good reason?
Yeah.
How would you have, done that differently, if at all?
Well, it's the situation that in which Mr. Spicer is doing his job is quite different than the circumstances that were in place when I was doing the job. The most concise way that I can think to describe it is simply that the president that I worked for was somebody who could handle a little criticism, somebody who almost to a fault was fact-based and rational and determined to set aside emotion to focus on facts and evidence and rationality.
to
almost
a fault.
Spock-like. Well, you know, he was sort of characterized as being Spock-like. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that's an entirely fair caricature, but I think there are some people who would say that he was rational to a fault. And thirdly, President Obama was somebody who had a very healthy respect for journalists, for the role that independent journalism plays in the success of any democracy, especially our democracy. Sean's boss is quite a bit different, right? Sean's boss is famously thin-skinned. Sean's boss is somebody who has shown in some cases, a willingness, in some cases, an eagerness to abjectly deny or ignore inconvenient facts. And it's not clear to me that President Trump has a full appreciation for how important independent journalism is to the success of our democracy. So all of that is to describe the situation that Sean is operating in, and that makes the job that he has virtually impossible, I think. But here's the other thing, which is those circumstances were not sprung on him at the last minute. Sean's not the victim of a bait and switch. This is something that we all knew about Sean's boss and the kind of White House he was likely to run long before he took the oath of office. So that's why it's hard for me to put myself in Sean's shoes, because the circumstances were so different. I think faced in the circumstances that I did the job and faced with the scenario that you've described, I would merely say to President Obama and my colleagues, we shouldn't make this argument because it's not one that we can defend. And so not only is it not true, it's not really, even if it were true and we just didn't have available evidence, it's not worth fighting over. Who really cares how many people showed up at the presidential inauguration? What are the consequences of that? And is that worth a fight less than 24 hours into the presidency? And I would make a forceful case that it's not. Now, I think what is also true is it is entirely possible that Sean or one or more of his colleagues did make that case to the president, but they were unsuccessful in persuading him. And it does not appear that President Trump is somebody who is interested in hearing advice from his staff that runs counter to his own instincts. And that's not a good recipe for handling all of the responsibilities that every president must handle. That President Obama would tell you that he really benefited from the diversity of views that were represented on his staff.
So every press secretary is accused of being at least mildly misleading, you included. It seems that there's a difference between things like misdirection or even deflecting and outright mendacity. There have been several instances now where there have been things that just don't have corroboration, where the president has kind of gotten out ahead of something, usually via Twitter, and the White House has backed up those claims seemingly without any kind of factual truth.
Yeah.
Do you see a big difference there?
I see a huge difference there. There are ample examples that you can point to of critics of the administration or political opponents of the administration accusing me of not telling the truth, but they were wrong. We could have there's no doubt that we had honest disagreements, but there was a commitment starting with the president to be honest. In fact, there was a real commitment on the part of President Obama to use facts and to marshal evidence and to present a forceful case about what we were doing, and to make an argument in support of what we were doing. And, you know, I was Peggy Noonan, somebody who I don't often agree with, did make a pretty important point and an interesting observation about President Trump's early tenure in office, which is she observed that he's missing a real opportunity to use the bully pulpit of the Oval Office, of the presidency, to make arguments. That instead what we hear from President Trump are assertions and mandates, not actually reasoned arguments that substantiate his view of the world or his agenda. And no one has a larger platform. No one is given more of an opportunity to argue for their case than the President of the United States. And that you know, based on the first couple of months that the President Trump has been in office, is something that he has not taken advantage of. And that's been true of his spokesperson, too, that Sean's only been doing this for 6 weeks. So I think it's too early to draw firm conclusions about how he will be graded when he leaves. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I tried to use the briefing room podium to do was to present new evidence, to look for facts that would substantiate the arguments that we were making about the virtues of our approach to solving problems. Mm-hmm. And I placed a real premium on trying to marshal new facts to include in the conversation. That didn't always mean that these were previously unreported facts, but just trying to put the facts together in a way that would draw on our collective knowledge. And right, when I say our, I mean the journalists who are in the room, people who follow politics closely, saying, hey, remember that thing from 6 months ago, that study that came out 6 months ago? Or remember that thing that Republican congressman said 4 months ago? Those are the kinds of things that end up making a case more persuasive. And, it doesn't appear, at least so far, that the Trump White House has been all that focused on persuasion. They seem to be quite a bit more focused on asserting their authority and continuing to engage and invigorate their base. But at some point, it's the responsibility of the president to be the president of the whole country. And at some point, it'll be a responsibility of the president to make a case that the entire country can at least be accessible to, even if they don't agree with it.
So in the Obama White House, where did the press operation fit when it came to policy? Mm-hmm. In one of your recent media appearances, you spoke about how you weren't privy to a lot of the things on national security matters. That makes a lot of sense that a press secretary would be privy only necessarily to what the public would need to know, not what is confidential. But at what point would the president and those around him make you a part of the planning process?
Mm-hmm. I can tell you that me and my colleagues in the communications department were a part of this policy planning process from the beginning. And the instances in which we were not included in that process were pretty rare, even when it came to national security issues. And the understanding was that we would be more effective in making an argument to the public about the wisdom of our approach to trying to solve a problem, including a foreign policy problem, national security problem, if we were mindful of how we were going to make that case from the beginning. It did not mean that the way that the public would perceive this would drive the decision about how to address this situation, but rather that if we were always mindful from the very beginning about how we're going to communicate a particular decision to the public, that we were more likely to arrive at a better decision that could be more forcefully argued to the public in a way that would have benefits for its success. Because, you know, President Obama enjoyed being able to paraphrase President Lincoln, who often said, I'm going to make sure I don't mess this up,
We won't hold you to it.
who often said that when you have public opinion, there's little that you can't do as President of the United States. But when you don't have public opinion, there's not very much that you're going to be able to get done, even when you're the President of the United States. And so the president was regularly mindful of how we could marshal the most effective case to the public about what we were doing. And again,
Do you think he was effective in that? I mean, given that he did have general support from the public for much of his administration, yeah, although it went up and down, and still he was stymied repeatedly by Congress or other issues.
Yeah. Look, when it comes to Congress, it was clear very early on that Republicans in Congress were going to engage in a strategy of obstruction. And that was not good for the country, but it did turn out to be helpful for the short-term electoral prospects of Republicans in Congress. It is not allowed Congress to enjoy a particularly high approval rating from the American public. And I do think that it is how Republicans found themselves in a situation where they basically spent 8 years just opposing the Obama agenda without putting forward any of their own. That's how you end up with a presidential candidate under the banner of your party who's got a bunch of views that aren't particularly conservative and has an agenda that's not at all well-defined, which leaves a lot of people wondering, including Republicans, what kind of agenda is President Trump going to pursue? And you know, and whether that is some skepticism about whether or not he's going to be as forceful as he should be in countering some government regulation, or is he going to be effective in repealing in Obamacare the way that so many Republicans want him to be? He may not be, but if he isn't, it's not because Republicans succeeded in actually putting forward the kind of agenda that people could rally around, including their presidential candidate. In fact, they've done the opposite, which is they haven't really had an agenda, and that's how you have a president that doesn't have a clear governing agenda and doesn't appear to be, at least with regard to some issues, all that conservative.
So a couple of weeks after you became press secretary, I believe this was in June of 2014, ISIS overtook the Iraqi city of Mosul. Mm-hmm. Can you describe the conversations that you had with the president, with your other colleagues, about how the president should respond to that?
Mm-hmm. Well, the challenge that the President Obama faced was grappling with the obvious and urgent humanitarian situation in that region of the world. You had these ISIS fighters that were marauding across the desert, raping and pillaging and massacring minorities, including Muslims, in Syria and Iraq. You also had extremists in Syria who were trying to use that chaos to establish a safe haven that they could use to plot and carry out attacks against the West, including the United States. And then you also had to deal with a really difficult political situation inside of Iraq that had essentially hollowed out the Iraqi military that wasn't able to withstand the onslaught of these marauding ISIS fighters. So President Obama, as he is wont to do, was methodical in ordering military operation to safeguard some minority populations that were at immediate risk. The most prominent example is there were this population of Yazidi Iraqis mm-hmm. Around Mount Sinjar. President Obama ordered a military operation to airdrop supplies to them.
Right.
And there was some military action that was taken to free some Yazidis who'd been cornered at the top of this mountain. And basically, U.S. military pilots took out some of the ISIS fighter positions that gave them an escape route.
So I guess what I'm kind of driving at really is your experience as press secretary during that happening. I mean, you had just become press secretary.
Yeah.
Obviously, you'd been in the administration for quite a while as a deputy press secretary before that. But when the news broke, you knew that this was something that the president was going to have to speak about. You obviously, there were some actions, like the ones you just detailed, that were going to be taken.
Yeah.
What was the process for you? I mean, where was your involvement there?
Yeah. Well, there was a lot of discussion about how to describe to the American people exactly what had happened and what role should President Obama himself play in describing our response to the American public. Mm-hmm. And obviously, President Obama wanted to be, given the stakes of the situation, wanted to be front and center in making this argument. You know, one of the things that was so challenging about the situation, and President Obama has made this observation before, which is that the quick dissolving of Iraqi security forces in the face of this ISIL onslaught is something that caught the United States by surprise. And so this is a good example of the kind of situation where few people, if any, predicted this a problem of this scale. There had always been this lingering concern about extremists in Iraq and in Syria, and whether or not extremists in Syria would be able to capitalize on the chaos in the country. And so the challenge that we faced is that dealing with a multifaceted problem like this, it has such grave consequences for the United States, is not something that you can just convene one meeting and determine how you're going to solve it. And so the real question was, how do we continue to communicate to the American public about what our approach is going to be before we've actually done the work of unveiling a comprehensive strategy to degrade and ultimately destroy ISIL, which is what we did. So, you know, President Obama did a news conference in the end of August of 2014 where he was asked about what the United States was going to do with regard to this, to the ISIL extremists in Syria. And President Obama famous or infamously said at the time, well, we don't have a strategy yet for Syria. And the president's political critics and the news media jumped all over him and said, ISIL has been a problem inside of Syria that we've known about for more than a year, and you still don't have a strategy to deal with it. What the president meant by that comment was, we are developing a strategy that will ultimately be very effective in degrading and ultimately destroying ISIL. And it was just a couple of weeks after what our opponents described as a gaffe that President Obama actually announced the commencement of airstrikes that were carried out not just by the United States, but by six or seven other Muslim-majority nations in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And their involvement was critical because ISIL was trying to characterize the fight as a war by the United States against Islam. And having these other Muslim-majority countries in the fight, literally flying side by side with U.S. military pilots, taking strikes on ISIL targets, undercut that message entirely. And it built the kind of foundation for an international coalition that we were able to successfully deploy against ISIL in a way that's had a lot of benefits for us. So this was a challenging time because you did have some of our political opponents who wanted to, you know, criticize the president for not having strategy, who wanted to second guess the president's strategy for withdrawing our troops from Iraq, and who also wanted to urge the president to be more forceful in taking the fight to ISIL, even though President Obama took the prudent approach, which was to build diplomatic and military support among other Muslim-majority nations so that we could send a clear signal not just to ISIL, but to their potential recruits and to people all around the world, that this is not the United States versus Islam. This is the United States and the international community, including the Muslim world, against ISIL.
You were press secretary from 2014 to 2017. What would you describe as your most stressful moment of that time?
Yeah. There are two that immediately come to mind. And the first is in March of 2015, President Obama came to the White House briefing room relatively early one morning and delivered a statement indicating that a U.S. hostage in the Afghanistan-Pakistan region had been killed in a U.S. counterterrorism operation. And this was a counterterrorism operation that had been carried out months before. It was something that had not previously been made public. But President Obama believed that this tragic mistake was one for which he should take responsibility and one that the United States should publicize to make clear to the world that when we make mistakes, we own up to it. And this was a challenging situation because it was obviously tragic. In fact, the United States intelligence community had actually dedicated thousands of man hours to trying to safely rescue Warren Weinstein, who was the USAID contractor who was kidnapped and then killed in this operation. So it was tragic at a very human level. Mm-hmm. It was complicated because there are many aspects of the operation that to this day remain classified, including the location of the operation. And it was also challenging because there was a concern about the political reverberations that this could potentially have in the United States. And I remember in the days leading up to the day of this announcement, you know, this is an example of a situation where there was starting to be some churn in the national security bureaucracy that I wasn't brought all the way in on yet. But I would see people in the hallway and they would say, we need to make sure we get you briefed up on this thing pretty soon because we're going to be counting on you. And I thought, well, what are we talking about? And they said, you'll find out soon. So a couple of days, you know, before this announcement was made, I sat down with some of the White House lawyers and some of the folks from the National Security Council, and we walked through what was just a terribly tragic situation. And, you know, part of my emotions were driven by what Dr. Weinstein's family must have thought at receiving this news. They must have just been heartbroken. And I can't imagine a family going through something like this. And, you know, by all accounts, this is somebody who was a patriotic American, a dedicated professional who traveled to Pakistan, putting himself in harm's way so that he could provide for needy families in the area. So it was just a tragic situation all around. And I was one that was on the hook. President Obama came and delivered a statement, made this announcement, and walked away from the podium saying, Josh will be out here later this afternoon to answer your questions. And I admired what President Obama did by taking responsibility for the tragic mistake. And so it was clearly the right thing to do, but it was a very stressful day for me. The other example that is a very different one and was stressful for different reasons, but was similarly challenging in terms of the briefing, was the day after the election. The country, even the world, was shocked by the outcome. To many people inside the Obama White House, the election outcome felt like a rebuke of all of the things that we had been focused on, that the American people had chosen to elect as president somebody who was foursquare against everything that President Obama had been advocating for, both in style and in substance, over the last 8 years. And people were looking to the White House to try to figure out what our reaction was going to be, both in terms of trying to make sense of the outcome, but also in terms of getting an early indication of just what the impact would be on the president's agenda. And you know, it was a similar situation. President Obama went to the Rose Garden, made a powerful statement about continuity of government and a commitment to democracy. And then I went out an hour later into the White House briefing room. And amid all of the emotion and amid all of the surprise and shock, I tried to project a sense of confidence and durability and reassurance to people whose confidence in our democracy was in many ways quite shaken. And it was a powerful day.
Can you describe that moment when you realized Hillary had lost the election and Donald Trump would be the next president?
I watched the election returns on the sofa in my living room with my wife. And, as the evening went on, at the beginning of the evening, the prospect of Donald Trump winning the election was not something I'd spent a lot of time thinking about. And I'm a voter in the state of Virginia, or the Commonwealth of Virginia, where I live. And so we were watching the returns from Virginia. Obviously, it's one of those states where the polls close relatively early in comparison to the rest of the country. And there was this sense in Virginia, as you were counting the votes, that Trump built up a lead, that over the course of the evening, Clinton steadily ate into his lead and eventually overtook him and won Virginia. And so that was, seeing the early returns from Virginia, my reaction was, oh, this may be a little bit closer than we had thought. And I was hopeful that we would see a phenomenon in other states where Trump had an early lead in the same way that we saw in Virginia that Clinton eventually overcame him. Mm-hmm. But that didn't really materialize in places like Florida and Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin. And it was a surprising outcome to me. And at some point when it became clear that it was unlikely that she was going to be able to overtake him in all of those states from those leads, my wife went to bed. And I stayed up to watch all of the returns and to watch his speech, knowing that I would have to do a briefing the next day to talk about it at some length. And so I was interested in what Clinton would say. I was interested in what Trump would say. And I was interested in what the immediate reaction to those comments would be. So I stayed up quite late watching, Secretary Clinton did not speak that evening, but President-elect Trump did. And I remember watching that speech and thinking to myself, we're in uncharted territory here. And that was true not just for the country, but that was also going to have real consequences for the briefing that I was getting prepared to do on about an hour and a half of sleep.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. But before we go, do you have any last-minute thoughts? Or if you were to have a very quick piece of advice for your successor, for Sean Spicer, or whoever succeeds him, what would it be?
I think the advice that I would have is to take the long view, to use the briefing as an opportunity to make a forceful argument, to present data and facts and evidence and make an argument, and to remember that the opportunity that you have to do that is going to come up every single day. And it's a reason not to needlessly spend credibility. It's a reason to avoid petty arguments. It's a reason to avoid, you know, particularly ostentatious shows of emotion. That playing the long game is valuable, particularly when you're in a situation like a daily briefing, where when you have day after day after day, when you have to walk out to that room, look people in the eye, and make that case, and do it under the spotlight, that it's worth protecting your credibility for a longer term play. It's worth not just assuming the worst of every journalist who wants to ask you a skeptical question. And I understand how that can be hard, that the goal of journalists, if they're doing their job well, they're going to be skeptical. They're going to be suspicious. They're going to get under your skin. And that's what they're supposed to do. And trying to keep that in mind, even in the toughest situations, is going to make whoever is standing behind that podium more effective at their job over the long term.
Well, former White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
HKS PolicyCast is a production of Harvard Kennedy School. I'm your host, Matt Cadwallader. Natalie Montana is our guest wrangler. Sarah Abrams, our sage advisor. And Becky Wickel, our digital guru. Send us your comments and questions to policycast@hks.harvard.edu or on Twitter @policycast. And subscribe on iTunes and elsewhere by visiting hkspolicycast.org. See you next week. Thank you.